KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Ian Brown and Christopher Marsden, authors of the recently released and now into second printing book, Regulating Code, Good Governance and Better Regulation in the Information Age, published by the MIT Press. These are words up front, code, regulation, information age, and of course are at the cornerstone of what Hearsay Culture has been over the last 7 years. And today we're going to dig deep with two experts who focus on this question of how code and governance and regulation work together. The book that Ian and Christopher have co-authored is a wonderful study of several what they call hard cases where you have to deal with the mixture of programming and software and government action and government regulation and technology that is not terribly well understood. And through the book, they take a close look at these kinds of intersections and what things we can learn about them, not only about decision making, but also about the way that law and regulation is created. And so as they talk about these hard cases, as they call them, we're going to talk about some of them on the show today. They include everything from copyright to secrecy and censorship. We're going to be digging down on these questions. As those of you who have listened to this show over the last 7 years know, we have spent a lot of time discussing the notion that Larry Lessig, the founder of CIS at Stanford, really brought to the fore, the notion of code being law, of software and of programming and programmers having far more influence on decision-making processes and what we can and cannot do on the internet than had previously been recognized. And so we spent the last 7 years talking with a range of scholars in the communications area, technologists, lawyers, intellectual property people, innovation, all of whom have different perspectives on this core idea. Today we're going to take a close look at this issue through Ian and Chris's book, and it's a wonderful opportunity to dig deep because we have both a technologist in Ian Brown and a law lawyer in Chris Marsden, a law professor, who can talk about these issues from these competing perspectives. And that reminds me, as we were talking prior to beginning the show today, I've had on guests like that before. Most recently, I've brought on people like Derek Bambauer and Oliver Day talking about hackers, or Fred Stutzman and Woody Hartzog talking about privacy issues. And now we're going to have the opportunity to dig deep in this question of code. This, of course, is an issue which is particularly important today given the range of questions and concerns that we have with regard to the Internet's ability to move information into hands that perhaps some people would not want them to be in, and to more freely break down walls that previously existed and barriers with regard to communication. And so whether it's everything from the high-profile issues involving Edward Snowden and NSA spying to perhaps the now somewhat less high-profile issues involving net neutrality, which, of course, has been in front of the courts here in the United States recently but had been off the radar screen for a few years, we have the opportunity, and in fact in the book itself, to dig deep into these issues and talk about these issues from, as Ian and Chris talk about it, in their introduction and throughout the book, from the perspective of both goods as well as interoperability, which we're going to talk about, and even human rights. So I'm very excited to have both Chris and Ian joining us today via Skype from London on the show. By way of very brief background, and I'll ask about their backgrounds in more detail as I usually do at the beginning, Ian Brown is a senior research fellow at Oxford University's Oxford Internet Institute. He's also the editor of the Research Handbook on Governance of the Internet. And Professor Chris Marsden is a professor of media law at the University of Sussex. So we are recording this show on October 16th, for airing, in fact, on October 16th, so this is quite timely. Ian and Chris, thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks.
So, Ian, I'll start with you, and I'll ask a bit more about your background and why you wrote this book, and then I'll ask basically the same question of Chris. So, Ian?
I've been working more on the technological side, although one reason that Chris and I work so well together is that we're, as well as being specialists in our own disciplines of computer science and law, we're both very interested in the other's discipline, if you like. So my My first degree and my PhD I spent a lot of time looking at information security, internet security. My PhD in particular was about how you can make the internet a lot more secure, and actually anticipating some of the questions that have been raised by all of the Snowden leaks over the summer, thinking about what intelligence agencies, particularly very well-resourced, very technologically sophisticated intelligence agencies like the National Security Agency, can and can't get access to. So that's been one of my abiding interests.
And Chris?
I think there's a couple of things that actually inspired the book itself. The first is that, obviously, having looked at these issues over many years, and both Ian and I are relative veterans from the mid-late 90s of looking at these issues, particularly, you have to understand, we wrote this book from the UK, and obviously we tapped into a lot of the US debates in the early days. And I think it's really obvious that it's a really good idea when you're writing a book like this to co-author it. And I should say this is co-authored properly. In other words, it's not a case of one person wrote one chapter and the other person wrote the other chapter. We did actually co-author to make sure that we actually have a blend as opposed to simply a kind of greatest hits type of a book approach. And I think the second element of this, which is really important in terms of how we wrote the book, is that we were very, very focused on the fact that we wanted to make sure that we covered both public and private goods and evils. In other words, we wanted to make sure that we joined up elements of what private companies are doing on the internet and what private individuals do and what governments are doing and what we do in our public lives. So we felt it was very important to look at all sides of the debate in that way. And frankly, if you're going to do that, it helps to write it with somebody else, because there's a whole range of insights that you need to have in order to give a properly rounded view of what happens.
So Ian, I want to follow up on that first point that Chris made with regard to this being a proper co-authored book. As you know, a lot of the audience are professors and authors, and so I'm going to ask you this kind of in the weeds procedural question, if you will, but I think it's useful. So, you know, it is without question challenging to co-author in the sense that you are intertwining your thoughts within chapters, as opposed to, as Chris said, doing, and I like the analogy, kind of a greatest hits where someone takes one part and you take the other. Describe some of the challenges of working in that way, and I really am thinking about this as not only challenges but advice, perhaps, to efforts to write in that manner.
It was quite an involved process. I think we were probably, from the first ideas we discussed together until publication, we were probably talking at least 4 years. So we've worked a lot on papers and other book chapters in the past. Some of these ideas germinated in 2008 when we were doing a paper for a law and technology conference in Europe called GIGI, some of the interoperability ideas. I remember, we found opportunities like transatlantic flights, for example, where we had a long periods of time when there was nothing else to do but talk to each other, that we took advantage of in working out some of the broader themes of the book. Then when we got down to writing it, we did start off by drafting about half of the book each, but then spent a lot of time over the following year then going backwards and forwards, doing a lot of revising, questioning. So as Chris said, there isn't any part of the book that's just one of us. We really spent a lot of time making sure that everything that's said in there we had discussed a lot, we had come to consensus on.
So, Chris, let me come to you and ask you this question up front. With regard to the book itself, particularly when you're writing in these areas that cross between, as we've already noted, high profile, popular, well-known news items and what could easily be considered more, inside, wonky kind of material, like, as we'll talk about today, things like net neutrality. How do you, perceive your audience for a book like this? For whom are you writing?
I think you have to be careful to make sure that, and this is a particular issue that academics need to deal with, you don't want to dumb down anything you're saying. You're writing for the educated expert, but you're not writing for an expert who's necessarily an academic expert, although we're obviously aware that a lot of our audience is academic, but people who are active in these areas, whether they're active in it through law and policy or active in it through engineering and perhaps standard-setting organizations, and try to make sure that it's accessible, but accessible in maybe some different ways than just are you an academic expert or not. Accessible, for instance, so that a U.S. audience understands what's happening from a European perspective and vice versa. So it's really challenging to write it in a way that has that accessibility that we're looking for, but we think it's really important because apart from anything else, if you want people to be able to have a serious debate about, take an obscure topic like data protection or take a very well-known topic like the Snowden leaks, if you just look at this from the perspective of one discipline or even one country, you don't understand the width of the discussion. So I think there's a challenge to do it that way. We've had some pleasing reactions from people. We've had some pleasing disagreements with people as well, where it's obvious that people are disagreeing with us for good reasons about the approach that we're taking and agreeing with us for similar reasons. I think that it's very much a question of making sure that you're not trying to simply dumb this down to a, you know, we don't want people to be reading this audience because they're reading this book because they're buying it in an airport. It's not that kind of book.
So we're chatting with Ian Brown and Christopher Marsden, authors of the book Regulating Code, Good Governance and Better Regulation in the Information Age, on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So gentlemen, given your respective backgrounds, I'm going to direct some of the questions to one or the other of you. But there's so much overlap here that feel free to, you know, go back and forth as you see fit. Obviously, as I mentioned in the introduction, many Hearsay Culture listeners are familiar with code as we understand it in the technology sector. Nonetheless, definitions may vary from author to author and scholar to scholar. So perhaps I'll ask you, Ian, to describe your collective definition of code as it relates to this work.
We used it in a broad sense to refer to the technological systems that shape so much of how individuals are interacting with each other and with businesses and government online through the internet. So it would include, but it's not limited to the software that's running on people's desktop machines, on their laptops, on their tablets, on their smartphones, but it also includes the code that's running on web servers, the infrastructure that's out there that makes up the internet. The technology that ISPs are running, the switches and the routers and so on. So, you know, that broad technological assemblage, if you like.
And then I'll ask a similar question to you, Chris, with regard to what perhaps is a more obvious definitional issue, but regulation. I mean, regulation itself even can be somewhat ambiguous. So what do you and Ian mean by regulation?
Right, so that's also taken in a broad sense. One could say regulation is simply the application of the law, but in actual fact, we're looking at regulation in a very broad socio-legal approach. So not only how do laws regulate code, but how does code regulate user behavior? So to take an example, we're conducting this conversation through Skype. There are obvious technical measures which Skype has, which enables us to have this conversation, but which also enables other things to happen as well. So regulation we're taking not simply as legal regulation, but also the way that code regulates us as well. And of course our interactions with technology and with law can regulate those things. So it's a very, and if you'll forgive me for using the expression, it's a very Lycidian way, you may not have heard the expression before, but to use the kind of adjective based on Lessig's approach, it's very much taking Larry Lessig's approach to definitions of regulation and definitions of code.
You had mentioned in the book, and by way of disclosure, for those that aren't familiar with this, Hearsay Culture is run through the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, as I mentioned at the beginning, which was founded by Larry Lessig. Lessig's work with regard to code, and then as it progressed, really focused more on code as it related to copyright primarily copyright, but other intellectual property issues as well. Of course, has been, as you indicate, mapped onto a variety of other fields and other areas that have nothing to do with intellectual property per se. You use the phrase regulation via technology, which is also seems like a very broad statement, but so that we understand the parameters of your work and therefore we understand the analysis that you're doing. Ian, what do you mean by that merged phrase, if you will, regulation via technology?
Well, that again is building very much on Lessig's code is law approach. What it's saying is, as you said, Lessig used the copyright and the digital rights management, the DRM systems that were so popular as a potential means for rights holders to enforce their rights in the 90s. That's one example where you had people getting access to media, particularly at the time, music online, and then being constrained in what they could do with that media, or even once they had bought it and put it onto their own personal computers and so on, they perhaps couldn't copy it, or could only copy it a limited number of times, or could only copy it onto devices that were made by the same people whose music stores that they were using. We know how that turned out, which wasn't well. That's one of our case studies, and you know, then moving on from there in copyright, other regulation via technology attempts by rights holders with the assistance of governments. So as is now more popular in many countries around the world, the idea of the graduated response, or the three strikes approach, where rights holders that detect infringing copies of their work being downloaded across peer-to-peer networks can report that to internet service providers. ISPs, after getting a certain number of those reports, then might send out warning letters to their customers, and as they receive more reports of infringement, then might start taking technical measures like slowing down the bandwidth that the customer is getting, blocking access to certain sites, so perhaps sites like the Pirate Bay, which are widely accused of infringing copyright. We've had those arguments in the UK, where some UK courts have actually ordered UK ISPs to block all of their customers' access to the Pirate Bay tracker sites in Sweden. But that's just one area, one of the ways we've tried to really broaden out the scope of this regulating via code approach is to look into other areas like privacy. So we have there some really interesting examples where social networking sites like Facebook, for example, clearly in the way they design their user interface and their systems do shape how much personal information their users are sharing and how widely. So you have the notorious 150 plus privacy settings in Facebook that people can choose, you know, is it friends? Is it friends of friends? Is it the public that can access different activities and different kinds of status updates people share on Facebook? Of course, Facebook has one interest, which is in encouraging their users to share more broadly, because that will tend to bring in other people, other new customers to Facebook. The debate then comes, of course, well, if some of those customers would actually like more privacy in place, they perhaps find that complexity of user interface, of user controls, difficult to deal with. Is there a role then for more traditional regulation and regulators to step in? What do privacy laws have to say about this? What do the national privacy regulators that all European Union countries have to say about this? So those are some of the ways we've tried to blend these different areas together in search of holistic solutions.
So General, let me ask you this. I mean, and there's a lot there in what Ian just said. But, you know, as we think about it, and I'm going to dive a little bit into the copyright issue before I kind of take a step back and kind of get your broad, thesis, if you will. But given what Ian said, you know, what is the role, if any, of a human being in this decision-making process that involves code, even as you define it? And let me give you an example, or two examples of what I'm referring to. First is, as I'm sure you know, Lessig himself was recently received via YouTube a notice and takedown letter regarding a video that he posted on YouTube that allegedly included a work that should not have been uploaded. So he's been accused effectively of copyright infringement. And Lessig himself, of course, is going to defend it. And as I say to I teach contracts, as I say to my 1L contract students, you have to make sure you know to whom you're sending letters like this, because you couldn't have picked a worse copyright defendant on the planet, arguably, than Lessig. But Lessig has pointed out that what his real interest here in this case is, aside from attempting to put some teeth into penalties for frivolous cease and notice and takedown letters, is he's concerned about the automation of this process, that in fact it's computers through algorithms that are sending these letters out, perhaps without any human interaction. So that's one example of kind of the role, the potential role or lack of role of a human. And another is based upon a conference I attended and spoke at this past weekend at New York University Law School involving drone technology, where you have unmanned aircraft that have a variety of functions, as we know, and where there may or may not be a human being on the ground directing what it does. So with those two kinds of examples, and I'll leave it to you to decide who wants to pick up the question first, what is the role of the human being as you see it today, particularly when we think about regulation by technology?
I think the Lessig YouTube example is a good one, because what you have both the downside and the upside from the perspective of the different actors involved, illustrated by that example. So on the one hand, clearly YouTube and systems like it, which are platforms for people to publish videos and other types of media, could not possibly work in a world in which somebody at YouTube or another company running that kind of platform had to manually check every bit of content that was uploaded before it was made public for copyright infringement and for all sorts of other works, all sorts of other problems you might get, like defamation, for example, or privacy infringements. So given that, and given that the very explicit protection you have for those kinds of intermediaries in US law, in the Communications Decency Act, similar protections for platforms and intermediaries in European law, which say that those platforms are only liable if they've been notified that they are hosting an infringing work or a defamatory work and so on. Clearly you have the opposite problem then. How do the rights holders on a scalable, in a scalable way, track down, works that are infringing their rights? YouTube has this automated system. As you said, it does sometimes get triggered. And the question then becomes the more difficult question of how far do you need humans involved at each stage to make sure that the outcomes are doing a reasonable job of balancing the different interests. So obviously freedom of expression is very important, and we focus a lot in our book on that, on privacy, on other underpinning constitutional rights that people have in most legal systems around the world, in making sure that kind of mistake doesn't happen. What's the process under US law, although not European law? Of course, if someone like YouTube receives one of these infringement notices and takes down a YouTube video, they will notify the user concerned. The user is able to file a put back notice, so the user can tell YouTube, no, actually this is not infringing. You know, I had a fair use defense, for example, or even more broadly, the rights holder has just made a real mistake here. This is not infringing their work, and the platform then, potentially, they're not required to, but they can choose to put the work back up and say, look, the rights holder and the user then need to fight it out in court ultimately if nobody can decide which is the right solution here. But it does show up the problems with going too far with automated detection and enforcement, because those detection systems will never ever be perfect. This is one of the big fundamental problems of enforcement by technology, rather than just trying to shape people's behavior by technology, because technology will make mistakes. You have to be very careful. The cure isn't worse than the disease, if you like. The mistakes don't start causing such large problems for the users of YouTube or even for the people running the platforms that they might then have to start thinking about really locking down the platforms in a way that will reduce their overall utility.
Yeah, and let me just expand on a couple of issues that we tackle actually early in the book, because we want to put our cards on the table pretty early.
Yep.
The first is that we worry about solutions that basically suggest that reforming statute can't do any good, because every time you reform a copyright statute, you end up with copyright being extended by many years and or attempts to root around copyright being made illegal. And this has obviously been a real problem that's occurred particularly in the United States. And, you know, we note in passing that obviously Lawrence Lessig's recent career is all about the fact that the belief that the moneyed interests in the United States make it very difficult to have sensible conversations about these things. So we say quite explicitly that we think that it is still possible somewhere in the world, and we give some examples of where we think it can happen, for there actually to be approaches towards information law which can actually still be logical and can actually try to serve the public interest rather than certain private moneyed interests who are paying legislators and others to actually perform that role. And I suppose Iceland would be an example with the Modern Media Initiative. But we also say that there's a real problem which can happen. I think a lot, particularly in the US, a lot of US authors have suggested that therefore the approach we need to take is for everyone to adopt very high levels of encryption, very high levels of technical knowledge, and that you end up with basically what's being described by Paul Ohm, amongst others, as the myth of the super user. That you come up with technological solutions to root around censorship, which only work for a few geek users. And, you know, we're geeks, we like geek law, but that's not a solution that's going to work for the broad mass of users. So we really worry about solutions which suggest that we can technologically root around the types of censorship that bad law can introduce. We don't think you can do that. And you may say, well, we're Europeans and we're believers in big government, and there may be a little bit to that, I don't think a great deal. But the fact is that we do need users to have protection from what we've described at one stage in the book, particularly in regard to privacy, as corporate social irresponsibility taking place. So we are believers in some types of regulation where there are egregious examples of corporations playing fast and loose with people's personal data, for instance. And we do think that there are areas where just because we can avoid the worst effects of regulation, we do need to bear in mind that super users are not the only people out there, and that we may need to actually set a bar at some point.
We're chatting with Ian Brown. I'm sorry, Ian, do you want to add something?
No, I think that's a good overview by Chris.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. We're chatting with Ian Brown and Christopher Marsden of... We're chatting with Ian Brown and Christopher Marsden, authors of the book Regulating Code, Good Governance and Better Regulation in the Information Age on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show and to listen to KZSU. So, gentlemen, you know, we've done quite a bit of background here, and I think it's important before we dive into some of the, in a little bit of the issues that you cover in the book. If there is a thesis, gentlemen, what is it? What would be your this is about as academic as it gets. What is the thesis, if you will, of regulating code?
The thesis is this, it's that if you want to actually achieve both good outcomes in terms of innovation, as well as good outcomes in terms of people's freedom of expression and their right to privacy, then you have to adopt an approach to this which doesn't simply say technology can solve this problem or law can solve this problem. You have to adopt a holistic approach to these things. And really the five case studies, the five hard cases that we take, are all about taking examples of where attempts to solve problems simply through technology or simply through law have not succeeded, and where we actually have real serious failures associated with the way that those particular areas have developed. So what we're saying is that we think that there's a real crisis here. The attempts at solutions that have previously been adopted have had to unfortunately take into account their local circumstances. For instance, a great skepticism of the ability of the US Congress to pass sensible laws in the future. So we're suggesting that to adopt this holistic approach, one has to regain some faith both in the ability of innovation to take place without permission, and also in the ability for lawmakers to try to come up with a solution which works in the public interest.
So, you know, you mentioned it, Chris, and perhaps I'll ask you, Ian. I mean, we are recording on October 16th as we record right now, and we're recording about 10:30 Eastern time on Wednesday, October 16th, as you obliquely allude to, right? The federal government, as it stands right now in the United States, is closed because of an impasse at the congressional level and the executive branch with regard to what our federal budget should look like. In light of this serious impasse, and quite frankly, by the time that people listen to this show via podcast, we could be in a very different economic time than we exist now if the elected federal leaders of the United States don't come to resolution. Given that kind of scenario, perhaps I'll ask you, and Aline, I'll turn to you and ask this. I mean, given that, does the U.S. maintain the same kind of regulatory control on the Internet today as it did even, and I'll say it, given what's going on, even perhaps a year ago? I'm not asking you to pull out a crystal ball, and predict the future as much as, in light of what's happening right now, what would you say about the U.S.'s ability to influence regulation on the Internet on a going-forward basis?
Well, of course, the U.S. government and the parts of it in particular that have statutory authority to impose some regulation, such as the FCC and the FTC in particular, are going to remain powerful players for as long as so many of the big Internet giants that bestride the global Internet today, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Microsofts, and so on. So long as those are U.S. corporations, and so long as the U.S. market itself, of hundreds of millions of, by global standards, very wealthy customers that are highly valuable targets for advertisers, if nothing else, clearly the U.S. government will have a strong potential influence in that way. I would say, actually, the federal government shutdown is a distraction from the much longer-term changes we're now just starting to see as a consequence of the Snowden leaks. Of course, we're all now much more aware, thanks to Edward Snowden, of some of the underground mechanisms, if you like, parts of the U.S. government have been using to put people under surveillance around the world, to shape the evolution of very important Internet technology, particularly encryption standards. But the sort of the counterblast that we're seeing from some other governments, particularly in South America, I think is incredibly significant for the future power and influence of the U.S. government in this field. So in particular, something that I think has gone slightly under the radar of the mainstream news media, but which is absolutely fascinating for us and for people interested in these Internet governance and regulation questions, is the fact that ICANN, which is responsible for the domain name system, so the body that ultimately controls how stanford.edu is translated into an IP address, has just in the last few days basically been making an alliance with the Brazilian government, which was already very unhappy about the sway that the U.S. had over the way that this global domain name system operates, to say, look, now that we know that the U.S. has been spying on the Brazilian government, on big Brazilian businesses like Petrobras, this really needs to stop and to change. And Brazil is now hosting with ICANN next April a global summit, they say, to decide how all governments and other stakeholders can participate on an equal footing. And they didn't need to put that in bold, but that was really the key issue there in the future governance of the Internet. And I think that is probably the most significant result to date of the Snowden leaks, that this prototype global Internet governance system we've had to date, which has been very strongly influenced by the U.S. government, ICANN ultimately is a private Californian corporation. That's, I think, now going to change. I think other governments will be very resolute in making sure that changes.
Chris, do you want to add anything on that front?
I think there's something very interesting, particularly given the day on which we're talking about this, which is that next week the United Nations, and I can hear people reaching for their guns already, but the United Nations Internet Governance Forum is meeting. This is an annual, it's a talk shop. It doesn't actually have any particular power of decision making, but it does have the power to set agendas. And they're meeting next week. It's an annual meeting. It's actually being hosted in Indonesia. And it will be the meeting at which these various forces, governments, as well as the private sector and standard-setting organizations and also non-governmental organizations are all getting together to have this critical discussion about, you know, where do we go now? Does the United States maintain its unilateral control over some of the critical aspects of the domain name system and other things? We can't have that proper conversation next week as things stand, because the United States administration officials who should be there, representing the United States won't be allowed to go unless there's some money allocated to it. So I'm running a workshop on Monday at the event itself, at the UNIGF, as it's called. And we're hoping to have somebody there from the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. But they can't go unless the shutdown stops. So it's a really weird situation where the shutdown in Washington is going to affect the United States government's ability to suggest that it maintain the status quo, which has worked out very well for American businesses. So it's a very odd moment in that sense.
There's, you know, there's so much there with what's going on, you know, as, and you write about, stakeholder processes and how civil society groups get involved in again, creating, regulation and law, which I want to talk about in a moment. But of course, as you know, along those same lines, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has been, going full bore, forward, despite, concerns about lack of, transparency and proper stakeholder input. And the flip side of it is that certainly you know, and I don't know that anyone said it outright, but certainly it, I think there's, you know, amongst people that focus on this, there's almost some relief in that, from that perspective, that things have also there stopped in terms of any formal negotiation because of the shutdown. And it has this dual effect of slowing down things that people want and slowing down things that people don't want, which, of course, is an odd regulatory lever. In light of what we were just talking about, Ian and Chris, and given one of the focuses of your book is censorship, let's dig a bit more deeply even into the issue of WikiLeaks. You know, you quoted a number of people focusing on the impact of really what amounts to, at least from my perspective, the lack of the ability to maintain secrets in today's internet economy and information flow world. And I'm curious to get your perspective on that. You know, one of the things that I've always found curious, and I continue to find curious, is the notion that governments feel that they can maintain a level of secrecy for purposes of efficiency or you know, capture, depending on your perspective, that it seems to be technologically quite challenging. And particularly given the fact that in the case of Snowden, it seems quite clear that the at least the federal government wasn't quite aware, or certainly wasn't monitoring the amount of access that he had. What's your take on a general criticism, again, of given the focus of your book, of regulation, that we put a level of primacy on secrecy that perhaps is not only warranted but even not possible today? So I'll open up to either of you who want to take that question on.
I think WikiLeaks and Snowden, I think that what they specifically tell us about that question is, I wouldn't say it's impossible for government bureaucracies to keep some secrets. Clearly, it's absolutely impossible if you give 850,000 people top secret clearances, as is apparently the case now in the US. And if you, as a quite understandable reaction to 9/11, say that one reason that the 9/11 attackers were able to plan and execute that operation was a lack of information sharing within the federal government, particularly the law enforcement and intelligence parts of it. I strongly suspect that when the large WikiLeaks cache of documents that came from Bradley Manning were published, there were many people within the National Security Agency, in particular, saying, "Look, we told you so." You know, there was a reason that some of those information sources within government were very tightly controlled. It's a very old, well understood intelligence maxim that you only share information, secret information, with people that have a need to know it. And if you share, you know, that quantity of information with every last lowly army private in, you know, as Manning was, I think, in Iraq at the time, clearly had absolutely no need whatsoever to be seeing all of these State Department cables, the notorious video that showed, I think, Reuters journalists being attacked by a U.S. helicopter, and so on. It's really not surprising in the end that kind of information then gets leaked. Snowden really surprised me in the sense that, as an information security specialist myself, I did think up until quite recently, if there's anyone in the world that knows how to keep some secrets really safe from a technical perspective, it would be NSA. And yet, from what Snowden has said, it seems absolutely astonishing that as a lowly system administrator, as he was, as a contractor even, not even a permanent full-time member of staff, he seems almost to have been able to roam at will across a lot of NSA's very secret systems. We don't know yet whether he got to the absolute core, to the absolutely most classified, compartmented systems, but what he has revealed really were the crown jewels of NSA. And so for me, it was a great surprise that NSA was so competent, so incompetent at their own internal security. How far you can go from that analysis to the much broader question that you ended with about, is secrecy and privacy possible at all in an information age? I personally think it is. Europe has much stronger privacy laws than the US. Actually, most of the world has now. Countries have much stronger privacy laws than the US, particularly regarding the private sector. The EU is updating its data protection laws. One thing that they are changing is to say, look, technology world, we need your help. Law on its own, I mean, very much fitting the thesis of our book, law on its own is not enough. We need the companies that are building the systems that manage all of this personal information that people are handing over voluntarily to be protecting it in an adequate way. So that's where ideas you might have heard of, like privacy by design and by default, which is supposed to be a principle of this new European law, is really important, because it says to the people building the technology, and especially it says to the people operating the technology, so the Facebooks, the Googles, the Microsofts, and so on, we need you to design your systems in a way that can effectively protect people's personal data, and actually we need you to be able to document to regulators how you went about that, so the regulators can have confidence in your systems.
Let me ask you this, gentlemen. Oh, sorry, Chris, go ahead.
Just to say, again, we just need to be a little bit careful about the super user. Yes, we're obviously all very concerned. I'm sure that the listeners to the show are also concerned about the implications of what Snowden's revealed, the implications for the National Security Agency, the implications for internet security itself, the implications for friends and enemies and allies around the world. But we should be aware that without The Guardian and The New York Times and traditional media organizations, we actually wouldn't have these concerns getting across to the wider public. And so we need to be, again, a little careful about the way in which one views the implications of the Snowden revelations. Yes, fascinating for us. In terms of how they'll affect the political process, in terms of how they'll affect the way that the US Congress, in as much as it has other things on its mind, the British Parliament, the European Parliament, other national parliaments, how much that happens is still very much something that will be affected by old as well as new media. So we just need to be aware about that. And the second thing I'd say, which is fascinating, we talk a little bit about the Pentagon Papers case in the book, and we talk about the Assistant Secretary of State at the time, Philip Crowley, talking about the fact that we must make sure that we're consistent with legal powers in the way in which we pursue these things. And these, of course, are old messages, but what's interesting is the extent to which they appear to have been circumvented by what's taken place and what's been revealed by Snowden.
We're chatting with Ian Brown and Christopher Marsden, authors of the book Regulating Code on KZCF from Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Gentlemen, we have about 10 minutes left on the interview, and this is what I call the unfair portion of the show, and that's where I start asking questions that you don't have time to answer in an adequate fashion, but yet I ask the questions anyway. And so, and we alluded to it earlier, and I want to come back to it, the differing influence and role of government versus corporations in the regulation of code, in regulation via technology. And perhaps I'll ask you, do you see an increasing or decreasing divergence of interest as between governments and their corporations, right? So whether it's the U.S. and Google or another country's government and their leading technology player. What do you take from that? Do you see corporations and governments diverting or in fact converging in terms of their shared or not shared interests?
I think there's a couple of elements to this. I mean, the first is, let's be clear, that these corporations obviously have multiple bases. So yes, Google, of course, is based in Mountain View. But Google has a couple of governments that have very, very specific interests when it comes to dealing with code and regulation. So it's not just the US government, it's not just the state of California, but it's also the Irish government. And many people who are listening to this may not know that the Irish Information Commissioner, the Irish Data Protection Regulator, is the regulator for Europe for Google. And if you think Google's important in terms of its importance to the US, Ireland, which is a small and was until recently a pretty badly bankrupted country, has a very different relationship with Google than the US government does. So we need to bear in mind that it's not just the home country relationship, but also the host country relationship. And people often focus on, well, how does Google get on with the Chinese government? A much more pertinent question is actually very often, how does Google get on with the Irish government? Mm-hmm. And how do those relationships work? And I think the second thing to say about that, which is really important, is that a lot of governments think that they can encourage this form of corporate social responsibility on the part of information companies. In other words, they think that they can achieve things via other approaches than statute to encourage companies to work together properly. And sometimes there just isn't a good match between the public interest and the private interest of companies. And a really good example of where that happens, of course, is when it comes to copyright, where the fact is that the intermediaries, and like Google and like Verizon and AT&T and so on, and the actual copyright holders, Hollywood studios, music producers and so on, don't have the same interests as each other and certainly don't have the same interests as users. And so one of the things we say is that the poor old user, who is also, of course, often a producer of items and uploader of stuff onto YouTube and so on, isn't being properly protected in the way in which these things work. And so that's why in the final chapter of the book, we talk a lot about what we talk of as a concept of prosumer law, the idea that law has to actually protect the little guy who's getting crushed between these very major interests, not just the interests of government, but the interests of conflicting major corporations. So sometimes you do have to go back to the basic need to actually protect the citizen, to protect the end user from what's being done by these corporations.
Ian, anything to add?
One place, of course, where you do absolutely see convergence of interests, which will make solving some of the thorny problems that Edward Snowden has highlighted in terms of government surveillance of internet users, is that big companies like Google are making a lot of money out of profiling their customers and showing them targeted adverts and so on. You know, that really is what the Facebook $100 billion valuation is based on. It's the all of the personal data they have on all of their users and the potential then to turn that into a revenue stream through showing them targeted adverts. And of course, that's precisely what the NSA would like as well. So there's a really tightly bound interest there, which makes it very difficult then when European regulators and governments come along and say, look, we want better, stronger privacy protections for Europeans when it comes to these businesses. We now know that behind the scenes, the US government managed to persuade the European Commission last year to drop parts of their proposed updates to European privacy law that would have made it more difficult for personal Europeans to be transferred to the US, where, of course, it would be accessible to NSA. And in the furore that we've had in Europe in response to Snowden's leaks, that's one thing that's been quickly resurrected by the European Parliament. They've added this anti-FISA clause, as it's known in Europe, back to this proposed legislation to make it harder for companies to transfer Europeans' data back to the States.
Everyone has been educated by Snowden's leaks this summer.
No, it's been quite an upheaval. General, let me ask you, as you know, we focus, drilled out about 5 minutes left in the interview. Your last chapter of the book is entitled Holistic Regulation of the Interoperable Internet, and where you get to solutions. And one of the things that you consistently point out in the book is your argument in favor of broader transnational or international regulation of internet activities. But perhaps I'll ask you, you know, what do you mean by holistic regulation of the interoperable internet as a solution to the problems that you identify through the hard cases, some of which we've covered here, but privacy, copyright, censorship, social networking, net neutrality?
I think it has several elements. So first of all, we say throughout the book, a lot of internet regulation scholarship today for very good reasons has focused on very narrow issues. So it might be privacy protections under US federal law or European law. It might be the application of competition law in telecommunications markets or to new internet services. It might be broader questions of human rights law in countries, particularly in European countries, that have a very long tradition of protecting human rights. But we think, as well as covering all of those areas, to get both efficient and effective and just regulation of the internet, you need to take all of those into account, and you need to be thinking about issues like who sets standards, how do you encourage interoperability and therefore promote competition and choice for consumers, how do you make a European human rights law tradition effective in a world where most of the companies that are so powerful in this space are American. And so we try to bring those all together. We hope that produces a useful whole at the end of it, although we are aware that it doesn't lead to a sort of, a very simple, resounding one or two sentence summary that we can give of the book.
Although I should say there is one element that we can say very clearly, which is that, and this will be apparent to many of your listeners, I'm sure, many legislators are spectacularly ignorant of the technologies which they're regulating. And they're also spectacularly ignorant of the types of human rights implications of those technologies. I suppose the second must follow from the first, because if they frankly don't know what the hell's, if they don't know what's happening on the internet, then they certainly won't know how that's going to impact on their constituents. And that's a huge problem. And in the same way, there's also a somewhat smaller problem, nevertheless a very large problem, which is that the companies and the individual engineers and software writers who are working in this space and creating the code environment that we talk about may well individually have a very strong sense of what they think the impact on society and the impact on individuals is going to be of the technologies they work with. But there's no actual consistent basis for ensuring that the companies do have to check that they're not engaging in these very, very, for instance, privacy invasive implications of their technologies. This is where we talk about corporate social irresponsibility, the failure to accept the implications of the technologies that you're dealing with. So we think there's a huge education process needed here. And we spend a good deal of time in that final chapter talking about the type of processes that are needed to actually embed in both the creation of new technologies and also new legislation more particularly, to actually embed these values. And then along comes the Snowden, WikiLeaks, Guardian, New York Times revelations this summer, making the same point we make academically in that book in a spectacularly public fashion, making it very obvious to politicians, to journalists, to technologists, and to the general public just how much we need to actually educate each other and to learn from each other about this new information environment that we work in. So I think He's made our point rather more pithily than a couple of academics would, but I suppose you'd sort of expect that might be the case.
Ian Brown and Christopher Marsden, authors of the book Regulating Code, Good Governance and Better Regulation in the Information Age. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show. It's a terrific book. I enjoyed reading it. It has influence and will influence some of the work that I'm doing. But thank you for taking the time today on the show to educate my listeners.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan.
I look forward, by the way, to inviting you back down the road as you indicate the Snowden revelations and other Snowdens yet to be named, I think will continue. And so I look forward to your insights there. I want to mention a number of guests upcoming on this quarter's Hearsay Culture schedule. Next week, Margot Kaminsky, the Executive Director of Yale Law School's Information Society Project on, along the lines of these issues, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and Transparency. Professor Victoria Stodden of Columbia University will be on. Professor Chris Sprigman of New York University School of Law, again on NSA spying. This is going to be a topic we're going to spend a good amount of time on. Denise Howell of This Week in Law, and Dan Nazer of the Electronic Freedom Foundation will be coming on as well. As I mentioned earlier in the quarter, show number 200 for Hearsay Culture is going to be recorded this quarter, and I'm in the final stages of arranging what will be an unusual show for Hearsay Culture, so stay tuned for that. As it stands now, I am booking guests for the winter quarter on KZSU's schedule, which will begin pretty much after the holiday season at the end of the year. Around January 1st. And so, as always, I welcome your suggestions and feedback for our guests that should be on the show. You have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You could listen by the old way, that is listening via radio, the wonderful medium, mind you, and one that I am dedicated to, but one that people may forget sometimes, particularly those of you listening via podcast, is another way to listen to Hearsay Culture. So you can listen on KZSU from 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can also stream it at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com or Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes page for CIS. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programs. And have a great day.